You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On last month's show, we welcomed singer, songwriter, guitarist Ty Curtis back to the neighborhood for his fourth appearance on the show. We've had Ty on just about every spring before Portland's annual Waterfront Blues Festival. To give us a preview of the festival and line up each year and play a few of his songs live in the studio. This year, because of the pandemic, Ty was zooming in from his home in Austin, Texas, and at that time there wasn't much of a festival to preview. The Waterfront Blues Festival, scheduled to run July 2nd through the 5th this summer, was sadly, but understandably, canceled to ensure the safety of attendees, staff, and performers. But I have good news for music fans, not just in Portland, but all over the world. KBOO usually brings you a live simulcast of the festival over the airwaves and online, and it's far and away our most popular event. The Mr. Jones's Neighborhood Baked Sale is a distant second. So this year, while there are no live performances, we'll be bringing you a virtual Waterfront Blues Festival featuring some of the best Blues Fest performances from the KBOO archives and other sources. We'll be broadcasting on Saturday, July 4th and Sunday, July 5th, going each day from 12 noon to 7 p.m. Pacific time, and it's all free. You'll just need to provide your own food, beverages, and fireworks if you're so inclined. If you'd like to help support the broadcast and the station, please consider donating to KBOO. We're community radio, serving the community, actually many communities here in Oregon, and providing a forum for the voices you don't often hear on mainstream media or anywhere else for that matter. We've been going strong, admittedly sometimes stronger than others, since 1968, and that's only possible through the support of listeners like you. About 80% of our operating budget each year comes from KBOO members. So we're hoping you'll show your support by becoming one if you're not already a member, or renew your membership if you are. Times are tough, and some of us are fiscally squeezed and anxious about the future, so don't worry if you can't spare any cash right now. But if you can give a little something to keep KBOO operating like we have been for the past 52 years, please go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button in the upper right. That's what a community's all about, neighbors helping neighbors. And speaking of neighbors and neighborhoods, we have a show to do, and it's a good one. Our guest is Portland-based author, teacher, and mom, Karen Russell. I first talked with Karen last June when her most recent book, Orange World and Other Stories, came out in hardcover and digital editions. That was for KBOO's Between the Covers program, and you can still stream download the interview on our website. We then had her back on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, along with Portland-based writers Kimberly King Parsons, Lydia Yuknovich, and Margaret Malone for our All-Star Short Story Summit in January, just before the novel coronavirus hit. That show was one of the high points of my time on the radio. By the way, I'd feel much better if it were short story coronavirus rather than novel coronavirus. Could trim at least a few months off the length of the pandemic. In any case, Orange World was just released in a paperback edition, so I invited Karen back to talk a little about the book and also how she's been doing while sheltering in place, and surprisingly enough, she accepted. I should first tell you a little about Karen if you don't already know her work. Orange World is Karen's fourth book, following the novel Swamplandia, the novella Sleep Donation, and two collections of short fiction, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Swamplandia was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the New York Public Library Young Lions Award, and one of the New York Times 10 Best Books of 2011. Karen has received a MacArthur Fellowship, and that's the famous Genius Grant, and a Guggenheim Award. She's currently the endowed chair of Texas State University's MFA program. Karen was born and raised in Miami, Florida, and now lives here in Portland, and I have to say, she's one of the kindest and funniest humans I've had the joy to interview. The initial plan was to talk with Karen for about 20 minutes or so and then play the interview we did last year when Orange World was first published, but we had such a fun time talking, we went for closer to 45 minutes, and I just couldn't bear to cut anything in the editing process. I hope after you listen, you'll feel the same way. So let's get to it, and if there's time, we'll play an excerpt from our June 2019 conversation to close things out. Here goes. Our guest today is Karen Russell, author of the story collection Orange World, which came out last May and was just released in a paperback edition. Karen, welcome back to the neighborhood.
Hey, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Now, the last time we talked was for the first time was Between the Covers last May, and that's when Orange World was first published in a hardcover edition. And then again for this show, and that was one of my favorite moments ever in radio, the All-Star Short Story Writers Summit with you, Kimberly King Parsons, Lydia Yuknovich, and Margaret Malone. That was last January, which compared to what we're all going through now seems like the halcyon days of yesteryear. How are you doing during the pandemic, especially with everything you're doing, the writing, the teaching job, two young children to care for?
We're doing, I think, really well relative to so many people, which I'm grateful for. And also, you know, the shadow side of that is, you know, I think we're all regarding, you know, from our very separate portholes, very different realities right now. I talked to my brother in New York, and I'm, you know, just aware that the view from his apartment window in no way resembles sort of what we're seeing here in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Portland. But I'm happy to be home. I was in Texas, in Austin, Texas, teaching. And I have to say, the last time I was here in the neighborhood with you, it was such a different neighborhood. We had...
We were actually at KABU. Yeah.
Yeah. We, you know, the lamp cast a shadow, and yeah, there. It's weird to be nostalgic for sort of a dimensional water cooler.
Well, you know. Yeah, the station actually has been closed down, so we're doing everything from home and sending in our audio. And the last I heard, they think it might be closed down for the rest of the year. It's just difficult with volunteers coming in and, you know, using microphones and touching the mixing boards and everything. It's hard to make that safe during a pandemic.
It's so funny. I was just talking with some friends about how everybody's imaginative faculties have been sort of, you know, really challenged by this time. And she was saying you just get a sense of how people's internal calendars work. Some people, you know, they have a plan until, you know, October, and then sort of there's just a lot of dead air. You know, some people seem, she was like, I can imagine up until like January 1st, 2021, and then nothing. And the tarmac to the future. I feel like it turns out people have just in a total void of, you know, information and nobody really knowing what's going to happen at all. I just feel like that is as like individuals, a fingerprint, sort of like how far you can sort of sprint into the future before things get really misty.
Oh, yeah. You have to take into account. I've done the same thing. I'd probably be scheduled through December at this point.
Right.
But you have to take into account people's, what they're thinking, their temperament, bouts of depression.
Right. Where they are on the hope and despair continuum. You know?
Yeah. Everybody is somewhere on there, like they say on the spectrum. You know, sometimes it hits hard and sometimes you feel a little bit more hope. Like recently with the protests, and you even got NASCAR banning the Confederate flag. So maybe we're on that, since we're recording this on Monday after Trump's Tulsa rally, which was very joyful for most of us who are opposed to Trump's candidacy.
I mean, I was talking with my husband about this, and we were just celebrating these Zoomers and the, you know, these young people who coordinated TikTok, not a platform that I, you know much about, but amazing, right? What a brilliant and life-saving push, because I honestly think, you know, in addition to just sort of the joy we all feel at the unmitigated disaster that was this rally for Trump, you know, fewer people attending an indoor rally probably means lives saved. So,
So it's a good thing for Tulsa, good thing for the country. Now, Karen, We talked a little bit about this before we I turned on the recording here, but there was a special issue of The New Yorker in April, which, as we said, seems so long ago now, but was, what, 2 months ago? It was called Dispatches from a Pandemic, and you contributed an essay along with other great writers in the U.S., and your essay was called How the Coronavirus Infected Our Vocabulary. You wrote of how you and your family were sheltering in place at the time and social distancing, all those new terms, in Austin, Texas. The essay begins, "Shakespeare did his finest work under quarantine." I keep hearing. But much of your quarantine is spent caring for your son and daughter. And I quote from the article, "Homeschool lessons this morning have included, your sister's head is not a bongo. Don't touch those crackers to your penis before you eat them, son." So I take it the quarantine was, at that point at least, was not very conducive to you doing your finest work.
No, it's funny. I feel like it was, and now that seems like just eons ago. It's a strange disorientation to hear something from just a few months ago and feel so completely alienated from whoever was thinking those thoughts and experiencing those things. But I did find, you know, this was pretty early on. It was such a novel thing to have all business shut down, school shut down, and be sheltering in place. And, you know, at least in certain sections of sort of the online world and in my inbox, people just kept saying things like, well, I hope you get a lot of good writing done. And I sort of felt, you know, I don't know, some people probably are doing the best work of their careers right now somewhere, but yeah, we're home all day, and it sort of like feels like running like a gentle asylum. That I've got two very mobile tiny people like on a search for fatally small objects all day. So they feel like that's, and I'm not saying I'm not proud of the work I'm doing, which is like stopping them from swallowing magnets, you know, that
that's extremely
value,
important
I
work.
Don't know that. I don't know if you find this with authors you're talking to, Ken, or in your own kind of creative work, there's a real low cloud that we're all under right now.
So yes.
It's hard to kind of feel, that's just something I think many people are, wherever you find yourself, they're sort of like, it's generalized in the atmosphere, I think, like it's a dark season. And I, even saying that, I'm also aware that, again, for us, like I have the luxury to stay home with my kids. So many people don't have that. I think I was teaching, and Texas started to reopen earlier than we did here in Portland. And a lot of my graduate students were faced with this choice of either losing, you know, their unemployment or returning to work. One girl managed a shoe store in a mall, and her entire family, her dad and mom, they were all furloughed or laid off. So she was like, yeah, I guess I'll go back there, even though, you know, they had people in their family with underlying conditions. I mean, it really breaks your heart. So I'm lucky to be able to stay home with these kids. Even as I'm pretty sure that I have like 10 remaining brain cells, and I find myself really leaning on Elmo to do some heavy lifting for me at this time.
I think that's kind of somewhat of an antidote to the depression and the hopelessness
is
grateful for what we've got.
It's so all consuming. I'm sure it would be that way anyways, you know, and it's sort of they really provide you with an imperative, you know, regardless of what's going on in the outside world, you know. You need to be like a stewardess in the great flight of their lives. So,
right.
And I do, but it's interesting to watch it. I mean, it's my son is 3 and a half, so I'm not sure exactly how much of this he's processing or what he makes of it. But immediately, I mean, within days of, you know, pulling him out of his preschool and, you know, we sort of stopped seeing these other kids, and he's like, well, I'm afraid of the germs. And he's pretty good, better than you would think a 3-year-old would be capable of being, of, you know, maintaining distance. But it's a little, there's a sadness to that. I think he's starting to go stir crazy. He's anthropomorphizing everything. He told me yesterday, Mama, I have a friend. It's my shadow. I was like, this is getting weird, kids.
Oh, wow. Well, and you write a little bit about that in that New Yorker essay as well.
And I think sort of everyone had their own experience at that time. But it was wild to me to feel sort of these new norms coming into place in a physical way collectively. I'm sure that you guys live some similar story here in Portland, but I mean, it would be the kind of thing where I would look back at something I did on Monday and think, what a monster, you know, who was that irresponsible stranger who, you know, let her son pick up a ball and throw it to another child. You know, I just thought, you know, we went into a coffee shop, you know, stuff that you did 72 hours ago suddenly seemed inconceivable. And that, I just think it was just interesting to sort of feel how dependent I was on what the other humans around me were doing.
Yeah, or what you were doing really, a few days before. I went, my youngest son, who's a lot older than your kids, we were, I think it was March 15th, we went to a concert at the Moda Center, a group called Tool, a rock band. And I remember we knew about COVID-19, but there was no quarantine yet. And I was on Max, the light rail, going back home, and there was a guy, we must have been about 3 inches apart, talking face-to-face, because it was a packed Max train, and just talking about the concert, and not a care in the world. And then, like a day or two later, I think that was Tool's actually last concert. The Moda Center shut down, venues across the country shut down right after March 15th. And I was thinking, man, the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be on pins and needles. You know, last night I was probably in the worst situation, and my son was too. So like all of a sudden,
right, to switch over into this new mode. It was funny. I mean, I feel like where we lived in Austin overlooked a street that was sort of full of bars and, you know, day drinkers. And there was this strange kind of 48-hour interval where you could participate mutually in these two alternate realities. Like you could be prepping for the apocalypse and just like buying lots of ammo and, you know, Charmin and salsa or whatever. And then you could like stroll down the street and like have a boozy brunch with your pals. And it wasn't, somehow they didn't, it was possible to kind of move between these registers, which is a weird thing, you know, as animals, that's kind of weird to, it reminded me, even though this is not a perfect analogy, but in Miami, you know, hurricane season came seasonally. And it was sort of like you'd cultivate this amnesia all year. And then this month would come where you'd be like, oh, that's right, where we could potentially get knocked off the map again. But there was a sort of like a darkly festive air, you know, and then of course, you know, when hurricanes actually hit, that's all, that, you know, there's a dramatic tone shift. But it was interesting to watch like that feeling of, oh, wait a second, all of the hierarchies are suspended now. And what I did find hopeful and still find hopeful, even though obviously things have fractured since then, and now it feels like there's some people who are like making out on Daytona Beach as we tape this, and you know, other people are like dressed like beekeepers in their own houses, you know, it's just like a strange time. But in the beginning, I was really struck because this wasn't, I would have thought cynically, I would have thought that it would have taken something even more dire before businesses shut down and people sort of volitionally started taking these precautions. And we saw that in Austin in those early days. And I found that kind of amazing. The speed, you know, which also gave everybody whiplash and was such a vertiginous thing to live through, but the speed that in fact, you know, and this, and there, I'm sure there were rural and urban divides and there are lots of other things, but like really truly tens of millions of people, you know, for a while there, 9 in 10 people were sheltering in place.
Yeah, and you were in Texas where you'd figure there'd be maybe more resistance due to the government and the kind of that old Texas spirit.
Very libertarian spirit. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And the other thing is, I mean, it was interesting once that messaging got across, you know, that the people, even asymptomatic people, were potentially vectors of this contagion. I thought there was something beautiful in that to me, just insofar as, you know, Austin's a pretty young town too. These college students, what we were hearing at that time was like, you're not personally really at risk. Maybe you'll get a mild flu, you know, flu-like symptoms, this and that. But like the people who will really suffer are these incredibly, you know, these vulnerable populations. So that I found, I was like, look at everybody taking these steps, you know, to protect our most vulnerable. So I feel like there still is something hopeful about that to me. I will say that, you know, I mean, things have gotten stranger and certainly less unified since then. And I think the message also has been pretty contradictory. So,
Definitely. In fact, you kind of end your essay that way. I want to get to that a little later, just so we would end on a more hopeful note.
Yes.
And you do. So I want to get to, since it's the release in paperback of Orange World, as mentioned, that came out in hardcover and ebook last May, and now the paperback edition has just been released. But I'd like to focus, since it really hit me again when I reread it, on the title story, which appeared first in The New Yorker. So at that time, you did this great interview in The New Yorker with Willing Davidson. And you said in that interview, becoming a mother is the oldest story out there, I realize, but it's new to me. The fear I felt during my own pregnancy and in the feverish early weeks following birth certainly seemed to have a diabolical tinge, which there's a demon in the story. And a new mother, Ray is her name, R-A-E. Do you still feel that fear, that diabolical tinge with your second child, your daughter Ada? She's about 6 months old now, something like
that? She's 9 months old.
Oh, my God.
I can't even believe it. I can't believe it. And she's, you know, she's like a giantess. She's doing everything like, you know, months earlier than her brother did, which I think is sort of common for second babies. I'm so happy to talk to you because I remember so clearly, you know, around this time last year, it was a much easier pregnancy in every way than my pregnancy with my son, but it's still tremendously uncertain time. Mm-hmm. And it is this sort of like double-edged feeling where on the one hand, something is growing unstoppably in your body. You have sort of no control. And then, you know, you also get this messaging that like, if you think the wrong thought, it could, you know, ineluctably alter the trajectory of your child forever, you know, or if you eat sushi, that could be the end. So it's sort of to hold both, right? Where you feel both sort of like influential in ways that far exceed your capacity to predict or control, and then also completely out of control. So I think even in like an easy pregnancy, there's still quite a bit of fear and uncertainty, and it's a lot to carry.
And especially now, as she's 9 months old, and here she's entering the world.
The big change for me, I feel I felt so much calmer this time around, probably because I had this three-year-old who was, you know, so demanding that I just didn't have time to feel much. I think that was kind of a gift. Thank God she's a very easy girl, so she's, you know, fine to just sort of be in her chair while he marauds around. That's the big change, Ken. So when we spoke last time, you know, I had like all kinds of fears, and they would range from sort of like kind of like, you know, globally apocalyptic fears and climate change and my own, you know, deeply flawed care, what all this stuff, right? And, you know, passing down addiction, like any number of things that I found pretty scary. And this time I feel like the biggest threat in our house was the toddler. that was interesting. Now I'm like, my mistake. The only right, like I'm not afraid of, you know, a demon. It's just this sweet three-year-old. A friend of mine said, he's like, toddlers are sort of like Lenny from Mice and Men, you know?
Whatever you say, George. I remember that the movie with Lon Chaney Jr. was Lenny.
I would say that's accurate. You know, it's just there's the line between love and aggression and a hug and a chokehold. It's a slippery line there.
Now, one of the things that hit me the most when I reread the story, it's mainly about the main character, Ray, and her baby, but it expands to four generations, actually. Near the end, Ray's mom is involved, and Ray's mom is taking care of her mother, which is Ray's grandmother, who's dying. So she needs to be spoon-fed. She needs to be groomed. And I wanted to read a passage from there that had me, I should put it in context, because I don't normally talk about myself in the interviews. I mean, you're the focus of the interview. But I mentioned to you that my dad had a second heart attack this year already, since February. And he's in rehab right now, recovering from a stent that was inserted. So it really hit me, but it was such a beautiful, beautiful... It comes near the end, so I don't think it gives anything away, but I just really want to read it, if that's okay.
I'm thrilled.
Okay. So this is the title story, Orange World. And Ray is at home in somewhat fictionalized neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, thinly disguised.
I'm going to disguise it better next time because I still want to patronize my local businesses.
I know. I was able to figure it out. I know the neighborhood. But Ray is on the phone with her mother, and you say that Ray's mom is calling from halfway across the globe, so somewhere very far from Portland. And this is from the story. At the same moment, they ask each other, is everything okay? While Ray watches her baby's eyelids crease and open, sunlight splashes all around the kitchen. Joy threatens to take the roof off the house. The light is almost blinding today. She crouches over him to shelter them both. A feeling leaps up into her from the past. Mother, you felt this way about me. Yes, her mother says, and I feel that way about you still. That is so beautiful and so true. And I really felt that with the current situation with my dad. It's like you hit something really universal there, universal nerve.
And I hope on all those generations. I read that way. It's funny. I mean, it's pretty spare. And I think I really only knew how to try to kind of make a signpost for a feeling that is very difficult to, you know, but it was that kind of beautifully radial sense of, you know, something that I think my friend said too, where she had her son and I asked her what it was like, you know, before I had kids. And she said, well, you know, a part of my consciousness is always with him now, but it's not necessarily, and it shouldn't be mutual. You know what I mean? And when you're a kid, you're not, you know, you're so self-absorbed necessarily, you know, when you're a toddler, when you're 15, whatever, you know, your life is very involving. And like another, you know, my friend has a teenager, he's like, I just feel like the invisible maypole that they, you know, live around, and, you know, I'm just the support staff and the great drama of their life, you know, and it should be that way probably, you know, but I think sort of realizing that in this, yeah, kind of circumnavigating, you know, going to like the dark side of the moon and then coming around again and feeling, oh my God, you know, it's a really amazing thing.
Yeah, we're so happy that you included that in the story. I know there's some autobiographical detail in there in that you said your mom actually took care of her mom when she was dying of ovarian cancer.
Yes, she did. And that really stayed with me. I remember, that was sort of an early, you know, before you really have the language for what you're witnessing. And that side of the love story, the other side of the parabola, you know, is there's something beautiful to me about, and like unbelievably painful. And it's funny, I was, when you were telling me the story about going on Father's Day, being with your son and your dad and sort of having this closed circuit
through the window. Yeah.
One of the hard things about this time, you know, I'm not able to see, my dad is in his late 70s, and our baby, you know, this has not been going on. It feels like a long time, right? But sort of at any other point, I don't know that I would be as acutely aware of what time does. But I just feel that so intensely right now. I'm like, my dad doesn't have so many summers left, right? I mean, that's just a fact. And our daughter changes daily. And so in this astronomical way, I mean, I think, you know, in a way that is completely uncanny, you know, one baby like swallows up another baby. Like she's been like seven different babies during this period. And our son too, you know, I mean, our son linguistically, like he isn't sort of like going from like the Flintstones to the Jetsons in the way she is, where, you know, she just pulled herself upright and it was sort of like watching evolution happen. You know, she looks so surprised and pleased.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Karen Russell, coming to us from her home in Portland, Oregon. Karen's latest book is the collection of short fiction Orange World and Other Stories, which was just released in a new paperback edition.
And I sort of was curious with the second baby. I was like, maybe those milestones won't be as, you know, astonishing to us.
Is that true?
But no, I'm still, you would think she was like Simone Biles, you know, she like rolls over and we're like, oh my God.
I know we were a little bit more mellow as parents with our second child.
We're so much more mellow. Yeah. That is so true. You know? Yes. And I think that it's a gift in a way, right? I feel like she's much more resilient because she's just had to like become a little person. You know, there's this unpredictable, tiny maniac in the house with us, just like sitting on her head and like blowing bubbles in her eye and swooping in to hug her. She's, you know, so I think, you know, she just sort of has to nurse with this like dogged, you know, like just like this tiny soldier. Just through some pretty brutal conditions. So I get kind of tongue-tied because I think there is something really, really amazing about feeling, watching your parents become grandparents. You know, that's not a transition that I expected to find as moving as I do. You know, I was sort of focused on in the other direction. And I think it's sort of, you know, I have a brother who's a writer, and we were joking. I think he gets frustrated sometimes because he'll go on these like perilous assignments, you know, and risk his life to like write a story. And he's like, the baby just blinks and she gets like a standing O, you know, just like a seal, you know, like nothing I have ever done truly in any prior point in my life has made my mom happier than just like the baby looking at something, you know, so.
Oh, Karen, can we mention his name? You mentioned he has a book coming out.
Oh, yes, thank you. So my brother is Kent Russell. He has a wonderful nonfiction book coming out about Florida in the land of easy living. When I was pregnant with my son, he was in parallel, which I thought was a pretty perilous journey that I was on, but, you know, it's also kind of private and, like, very commonplace. My brother, during those same months, was walking the entire state of Florida from the panhandle down to Miami.
What a great idea.
It's great. It's a great book. And, you know, it's eerie to read it now. So much of it is about kind of like the different, you know, Florida is not a monolith. There's so many different.
I was just going to say that.
Red,
yeah.
You know, and so reading him move from these like deeply religious conservative zones, you know, and then South Miami is like an international capital. So he sort of traverses all of these pocket universes inside Florida. And he predicted, too, during the course of this book in 2016, he was like, Florida's going to go Trump and Trump's going to win the election. So
what is he saying?
It's an interesting read right now. You know, we were talking about this terrifying time.
What's he say about 2020?
You know, I think he thinks that Biden's going to win. So,
oh, that's good. Well, yeah.
But who knows, right? I mean, I didn't know. There's just been nothing that I've predicted correctly. So,
well, that ray of hope leads me to the next question. That's what we were kind of implying before when we were talking about the hopefulness to take out of what seems like a disaster currently. When I researched our interview for Orange World, you about that same time, just before the interview, you had another interview come out in the journal Electric Lit, which is an online journal.
Oh, yeah. I love Electric Lit.
Yeah, and you mentioned a book called A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit. And in the book, you said that, I'm quoting you here, Solnit pushes back against the idea that after a disaster, the thin veneer of civilization is ripped away and everyone reveals their true monstrosity. Mm-hmm. She says, no, that's not what happens after disaster. And she did a lot of research on this. Solnit talks about the somber joy people feel when suddenly all hierarchies are suspended and they're permitted to be their best selves, actually. They're helping one another and coming together to form these new kinds of communities. Mm-hmm. And in that New Yorker essay that you wrote back in April, late March, you mentioned something similar about, the comparison was between, it was a beautiful image. It was about starlings in the park. Mm-hmm. And you related that to how people were kind of reacting in a similar way to the pandemic. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, for sure. And it's funny. I mean, I think to refresh that metaphor a little bit, I felt similarly watching these protests, you know, watching sort of a local outrage and sorrow spread in this way, you know, and become a chorus demanding change, you know, at a volume that I don't know I've heard in my lifetime, and that's working, you know? So yeah, I sort of had a similar feeling watching that surge, you know, it felt like this living fist, you know, pushing, everyone pushing together and in a peaceful way, but, you know, on the protester side anyhow. But starlings, if you've never seen them, it's worth a Google search. They're a bird that was brought here by a Shakespeare enthusiast who wanted to bring over every bird that the bard wrote about. So they're sort of this invasive species. Farmers don't love them. You know, they're not a beloved bird in certain agricultural sectors of this country, but I think they're so beautiful. They're these beautiful, you know, our daughter's middle name is Starling. It's a family name. And I like how it sounds like extraterrestrial too, but they're these tremendous flocks, these murmurations that they look animate. It looks like if like pieces of sky jigsawed together, and that the speed at which they move is astonishing. So you sort of wonder how all of these local players could cohere into this dervishing. You know, it looks, and it's sort of like it'll become a cyclone. It's almost like Etch-a-Sketch like, you know, if you watch it. It's sort of like shapes assert themselves and scatter apart again, and then and researchers discovered that the birds are attending to the seven nearest starlings. So the way that they pivot so quickly is they're really rippling cues to their neighbors. And then that's how this, you know, this like thousand strong bird cloud is able to move with one mind. And there was something that felt analogous to me about sort of, so, you know, the distance that we're all keeping, people are like more aware of their bodies and physical space right now, or I am, you know, I'm sort of like a Mr. Magoo-like person generally. So I've had to wake up a little bit out of my own cloud. And I feel others doing that too, you know, and sort of gauging distance. And then just beyond that, sort of knowing that we're all choreographing our bodies and space together to protect one another, there was something beautiful to me about that. I'm sure, you know, there are other interpretations, and that, you know, there are definitely some assholes out there too. You know, I'm not saying that everybody is like this gorgeous starling in a big, you know, sky ballet. And it's sort of, it's not always, right? In this case, it's not sort of like top down. It's not something dictated from above. It's something that's rippling outward in a community, you know, and whether it's, okay, we're all gonna behave in these new ways to ride through a turbulent season together. You know, we're gonna ride this out together, and we're gonna coordinate locally, and it's gonna have a global impact on, you know, flattening the curve. It's gonna save many lives if we do this. That seemed beautiful to me. It seems also truly inspiring to me to see people, these protests that are not, you know, keeping the pressure on, and that are having immediate impacts on policy and on, you know, conversations too. Sort of like this contagion of, I talk about the linguistic contagion that I felt like happened in the goofy language around the coronavirus. But I think something similarly is happening now, right? You look at the bestseller list right now. I mean,
Yes.
it's astonishing.
Ta-Nehisi Coates books and there's lists going around, but yeah, we talked about it before we started recording, but it de definitely seems like a turning point where you've got NASCAR banning the Confederate flag, the NFL saying Cap, come back, you know, we're sorry we were so mean to you when you took a knee. Drew Brees, a quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, was trying to use that old, you know, I hate anybody disrespecting the American flag, but it didn't work this time.
Didn't work this
People
time.
pointed
We
out
got
the
a lot of
difference.
past cashed,
Yeah, and the whole thing, I
yes.
think, with Trump and his law and order doesn't seem to be working either, and that worked for Republicans in the past too. And that all lives matter, that used to be, that would shut almost anybody up in the old days meaning maybe even a year ago, but
Yes.
it's not working now.
Yes. You know what I think also felt sort of this, it's not to return to my nerdy, it's like very nerdy metaphor, but I mean that reading, go, I, you know, going on this deep dive again, if people have some time right now, if you're stuck at home, interesting to read about how these birds navigate and manage uncertainty and consensus. But I found that also kind of incredible, this idea that like you could play this orienting role for your neighbors and they play that for you as well. And of course, it doesn't have to be in our digital age. You know, it doesn't have to be sort of like the person right across the street from you. You know, it can be the people that are in your own, that you're close to, that are in your community. You know, and so just, yeah, thinking like it, this is a way that like we can move sort of these behemoth institutions
Yes.
more quickly than you would expect, right? Or sort of drive policy, you know, drive these policy changes.
Yeah, you had talked about again before we started recording, but man, I should have just aired that. But the corporation sending out all sorts of Black Lives Matters
Right. And
email
I'm,
right
you know,
now.
I some of them I feel more cynical about than others, certainly, right? But just the sudden, like you, and we, I guess we have, you know, Me Too is another sort of inflection point like this, right? And even if you sort of roll your eyes and think that certain companies or individuals are doing this just to pay lip service to it or out of, you know, for self-serving reasons, I do feel like there is a genuine, you know, rumbling, like upwelling. And you see it, I really heard in the street, it was, we took Oscar to the family-friendly protest. You know, and the energy there was just incredible. It felt like revisionary energy. Also, I have to say that was like the most people I've seen in months. So we were all a little really stimulated.
Was that at Revolution Hall?
We didn't. No, we weren't. It was at Irving Park.
So oh, okay.
I wish we could have gone to Revolution. My dad is going to come up, so we've been playing it safe a little bit with super, super, super crowds.
Now, I want to get to, two last questions. And one is about when we last talked, you had a work in progress, and it's what you call an historical, fantastical novel set in the Dust Bowl era about an imaginary town during the drought and also during the Great Depression. Your timing actually couldn't be better because we appear to be heading into another Great Depression. But how is that book coming along? Are you taking some inspiration?
That's not what you want to celebrate, right? Like,
don't. But
so many resonances. it's coming along. It's sort of changed a lot on me, and it's been around for such a long time now that I'm just going to knock on wood talking to you. I hope I will be so happy, Ken, when that book comes out. You have to have me back on the show, and then we can just. Hopefully this virus will be a distant memory. We can just body slam and high five.
Well, we do have another date in the not too distant future. And that's for the other thing I want to talk about before I let you go. And that's you had a novella come out about 6 years ago. I think it was 2014.
Was it 6 years ago?
Yeah, that's when you did the interview with David Naiman for Between the Covers on that.
I have to tell you, in my mind, that was not, you know, it was a very recent interview. So that's.
No. Yeah. So I went back. I actually listened to it. Unfortunately, it was a very difficult book to get a hold of because it was published as an ebook only, an e-novella, by a company that thought, I guess, they were going to start this whole trend and create this great business of just exclusive ebooks. But they went out of business, so the book unfortunately went out of print. But Vintage is bringing it back in the fall, so there'll be a print edition. And
yeah,
I guess
I'm
an ebook.
I'm so excited about it. I can't wait to send you a physical copy. It was really fun to do. This digital only book, and in some ways I sort of thought the story was perfect for that medium because it's about an insomnia crisis that may or may not be caused by our glowing devices, you know, so it just seemed fun to imagine people reading it on this medium. I think it was a little bit critical of sort of the 24/7 news cycle and sort of like this accelerated way that we live right now, but then it sort of disappeared, and that's a
yes.
sorrow, you know. And so I'm so excited that it'll be something people can hold in their hands. And I worked with these Italian illustrators. I think the weird thing about the timing, you know, for me, is that the book is about a nightmare contagion. So it's this America where everybody has lost the ability to sleep. There's this sort of like orexin dysfunction in the brain of these insomniacs, and they need sleep donations to live. And I wrote this before kids, so also I feel like I knew nothing at that time about the horrors.
Sleep
of chronic
deprivation, sleep. Yes.
Rereading it, I was like, I was such a fool. Like I barely understood what it's like to just feel out of your mind with, you know, sleep loss. But and there's a dream, you know, that the national sleep supply becomes contaminated, and there are these sort of these contagious nightmares. And so I was working with these Italian artists, Ale and Ale, who are truly amazing. These dark, whimsical, wonderful artists. And at a certain point, they had to go into lockdown. So we had to cease working on this. But our email correspondence is so bizarre to me now, you know, because there was this real pandemic at the time we were working on this nightmare contagion map. You know, so they'd be like, where do you want me to put the grasshopper nightmare? Should it be more in the Midwest? You know, should the jellyfish dream? Is that like the mid-Atlantic states? And while we were working on this, you know, the world, the reality outpaced us. So that, you know, I hope that people still want to read something about a nightmare epidemic, you know.
Well, during the pandemic, I mean, I've got several friends who have talked about waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning and having trouble get back to sleep just
yeah.
because of all the stress and worry going on. So
yeah.
I think that book will never go out of date.
You know, isn't that my way? I had to go to the dentist and he said that people are just grinding their teeth down to nubs. You know, he's like,
I catch myself grinding my teeth during the day.
And normally I would stop, but I just said, oh, it's one of the few pleasures I have right now. So go ahead. grind your teeth.
Yeah. There's a book I love by a friend of mine, Karen Thompson Walker, called The Dreamers. And she has this line that I just keep thinking about these past few months, you know, about how the, and I'm paraphrasing her, but how the avenues of love and friendship and connection are the same routes that the disease travels. And that's really something that seems especially cruel about this time, you know, is sort of becoming aware of like all of the human bridges that we have to, you know, the bridge has to come up for a little while we wait this thing out.
Right.
Hard.
Yeah. We don't have the quite the social connections that we do, or they're a lot harder to come by, you know, at six feet from each other.
Yeah, I know. And this, I was thinking about sort of dreams too. People have reported having these really vivid dreams to me kind of in recent weeks. And it feels plausible to me. It just feels plausible that there might be like a nightmare that, you know, everybody in the tri-county area dreams together, you know?
A collective unconscious, yeah.
It feels like that, right? And then, yeah, these sort of regional, you know, local to global.
Maybe like those starlings.
Yeah. Yeah, if anything, I feel like we'll come out of this with a new awareness of how interdependent we are, you know, and how for better and for worse, our fates are, you know, no one has. Yeah, you can be the captain of your soul, but you're still sort of, you know, living in this great body, you know, with your fellow citizens.
I promise you just those last two questions, but that brought up one more, and that will be the last. When you talked about the vivid dreams, your work is often kind of classed as fabulist, surrealist. You know, there's some strange things that happen in there, and now a lot of people are having those dreams, those visions. Has anything come out of this in the last few months for you that kind of beyond what you would normally be thinking of, kind of going into areas, you know, maybe coming out of your dreams, vivid dreams?
Gosh, I wish that I was having interesting dreams, Ken. I feel like I have a lot of anxiety dreams, but they still tend to, you know, it'll be like, oh my God, my daughter is at the top of the stairs. You know, it's not right. Really like, oh no, I left a hamburger patty where the baby can get it, you know, or whatever. It's the
Orange World.
But I feel like, and this happened with my son too, you like the imagination. I was just like, who is the DJ in the DJ booth? This is so boring and repetitive. Like, but I think it's kind of necessary where, yeah, the nightmares I'm having are just not exciting. You know, it's like a box of crayons is in the crib, you know? but I have no doubt that we're going to see some frightening, you know, like a funhouse mirror of this time. And I'm sure some very beautiful stuff too. For me, I think I have been surprised at deeper veins of cynicism have been exposed in me, and also just, and it really, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's possible, you know, it's actually possible to change the world and our behavior. And we can do it when we think the stakes warrant it, right? I mean, when we're saying, and I think the stakes really are life or death on things like racial justice, climate change. I mean, we have to find a way to profoundly revise how we live and treat each other. And it's, you know, it's wonderful to hear in our streets, you know, those cries. So that's new for me in my lifetime. I mean, I think that you probably have had, not to date you, Ken, but
I'm a generation older than you.
Yeah, different, I've lived through some very convulsive periods. I would say this is exciting, very exciting to me to see what feels like a sincerely multi-generational, you know, interracial push.
Yeah, and you had mentioned the Zoomers, so the young people coming in.
I'm so inspired by the Zoomers.
Yeah. So you guys had your chance. We're going to come in and save the world.
No, I mean, it's true. My friend was saying that. He's like, wow, this new generation is so much better than we were. Like, well, we got to get on. Let's join them out there.
Yeah, my generation started off okay, but I don't think we kind of followed through, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think there's still time. I feel like Oscar's, the cameras in his mind have just turned on. He's just started making memories. So it's like given given a new urgency to the whole. I'm like, oh, it's now he's telling himself the story of his life. So let's do what we can to, you know,
right,
turn this ship around.
Well, Karen, it's always a joy to talk to you, and you just actually just brightened up my whole week, if not month, with this Zoom conversation.
Oh, same.
So,
I do love my children, but you know, let's be honest, we're a lot smarter than they are, so it's just a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, maybe you are. I wouldn't make that claim yet, but thanks so much for joining us in the neighborhood today.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me. I really look forward to it so much.
That was our very recent conversation with Karen Russell, author of the collection of short fiction Orange World and Other Stories, which was just released in a new paperback edition. We have time for a brief excerpt from the interview we did with Karen last June, when Orange World was first released in hardcover and digital editions. In this segment, we talk about Karen's love for short stories and my love for Karen's short stories. Now, Orange World is your third collection of stories, and you've said, quote, "Stories feel special to me because each can become a kind of universe in miniature. As a kid, I loved snow globes, my sister does too, and museum dioramas, maybe for the same reason. I also think stories can haunt you in a very particular way, their velocity and their compactness. I always have the sense, too, with my favorite stories that the world of the story is still spinning somewhere long after I finish the last page. Because of a story's brevity, you can almost hold it in the palm of your hand. You can walk around its periphery. It stays with you in a different way, I think, than a novel. A story can work on you almost like a poem. You read it in one sustained burst, and it has a different kind of integrity inside you," which I find as a reader of your stories. But does this apply to your writing the stories as well as being a reader of other people's stories?
Oh, my God. I so wish. And I also should say, hearing that, hearing you read that, I feel like I'm compelled to tell listeners, these stories are long as hell. Like, I feel like you might not, you know, I forgive anybody who needs to take a break to eat a sandwich and then returns to read
oh,
these
no,
stories.
Oh, no, that's not true, Karen. It's
they're
the 40
really
pages.
Long.
I don't think you're going to be able, I don't think you're going to want to leave and eat a sandwich in
but
the middle of it.
But I love reading. I do really, if it's possible, that's my preferred way to read a story, is just to go from beginning to end and just kind of parachute into that world and stay there. And there is something about the experience of reading something in one sustained burst. I do just find you sort of like, it's almost like a dream returning to your body or something. You have it kind of whole cloth, you know?
Right.
And that's not always novels take me forever to read. I'm a very slow reader. So I'll have just a more fragmented memory of them for some reason. But I wish it would be my dream to, like, I hear this happens to other people where they sit down and they're like, a voice went blazing through me and I finished the story that afternoon and like high-fived myself and, you know, I don't know, like,
wow,
went out for drinks. That's never been my experience. I have never down on fire, you know, and just sort of a story pours out of me and then I'm spent and I'm like so exhilarated. It's
but it would great be great
wouldn't
if
that
it
be
happened.
Great?
Yes.
Oh my God, that is truly my dream. I would love, I invite any ghost to come and like possess me and just like fly over the keyboard. And then I get to go out to dinner and I'm like, cool, I wrote a story.
I just need seven more and I have
right.
a book.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Exactly.
Be published next week.
yeah, right. I'm going to be laughing all the way to the bank.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Karen Russell for joining us from her home in Portland. Karen's incredible collection of short fiction, Orange World and Other Stories, is now available in a new paperback edition, and you can take it from someone who reads a lot of books. Orange World was one of the very best of 2019, and any other year for that matter. You can find out more about the book and Karen's other work at KarenRussellAuthor.com. Just to note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, July 24th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. In the meantime, many thanks to the KABU staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, Jenka, Otto, and others, who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is keeping their distance and making radio from home. And many thanks to all of you as well for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, may there be better and more beautiful days ahead. We'll close today's show with a track from Brian Eno in homage to Karen Russell and Orange World. This one's called Another Green World.